This is a Cities of Refuge podcast where we talk about migration, human rights, and the role of cities and local authorities. My name is Sarah Millet, and I'm a PhD researcher at Utrecht University and a member of the Cities of Refuge research team. Hello, and welcome back to the Cities of Refuge podcast. In today's episode, we are going to focus on cities, migration, human rights, and public space. As a geographer, I'm very excited to focus on space, not in faraway galaxies, of course, but around the corner. The public spaces in our cities and the role that they play in the everyday experiences of young refugees in different European cities in particular. Public space is something that we tend to take for granted. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, however, public space has come under unprecedented pressure. Lockdowns and social distancing measures are changing the way we think, use, and feel about public spaces and the encounters and interactions with others within them. All the more reason to expand the focus of our previous episodes, where we talked about cities as global actors in transnational networks and the agents within them, such as mayors. To complement and to reorient our focus towards cities, migration, and public space, I am joined today by Dr. Ilse van Diemt. Ilse is an associate professor in urban geography at Utrecht University, where she is also the research leader of the university-wide focus area on migration and societal change. She is an expert in forced migration, and as a scholar, she has a cross-cutting perspective, having published widely on irregular migration, refugee settlement, gender, and public space. Her research on public space includes exciting topics such as geographies of the night, nightlife districts, and surveillance. Currently, Ilse is working on, among other things, a very interesting HERA research project that zooms in on the everyday experiences of young refugees and asylum seekers in public spaces. It is this project in particular that I am excited to hear more about today. Last but not least, Ilse is a close colleague. She is a fellow geographer with whom I have previously worked in several projects and a close friend. Ilse, hello and welcome. It is so great that you're joining us today.
Thank you. I'm also really excited to be part of this podcast.
Yes, we've been talking about it for some time now. So let me start with a general question then. In your HERA research, you look at the role of public spaces in the everyday life and settlement experiences of young refugees or refugee youth. Can you tell us something more about this very interesting project, the sort of questions it is focusing on, and also for our listeners, what excites you personally about this focus on urban space?
Yeah, sure. So the HERA project, as you rightly pointed out, focuses on the role of public space in the lives of refugee youth. So we ask questions around how refugee youth experiences public space, how they use it, but also questions around inclusion and exclusion in public space. And what I think is exciting about it is that we focus on the city and not on the state, which I think is a really important distinction. So I've been involved in several projects where sometimes national policies were really the focus. But I think this project to me is particularly exciting because we really take the city as our starting point. So we look at Newcastle, Leipzig, Brussels, and Amsterdam. And within these cities, we also take the perspective of the everyday, which also personally really is something that I'm very interested about. I think a lot of the classical migration literature that looks at newcomers who arrive in cities have a really strong policy perspective, but also very strong neighborhood perspective, which I think as geographers we're interested in. But at the same time, I feel that the literature, for example, on ethnic enclaves or neighborhoods is also very limiting. So I like the fact that we take public space as our starting point. So we look at the city as a space in itself, as a context, and we're specifically interested in how people use public space. And this can be public space in your own neighborhood, but it can also go way beyond that because public space, I think the word in itself already kind of tells you that it's public, so it's accessible for all in principle. It gives a lot of opportunity for newcomers to meet new people, to encounter new ideas, new people, it's even a space where new identities are constructed. So by meeting other people, by just being confronted with new things, something interesting happens. So I think that's what excites me most about it.
Yeah, I completely understand. I also find it very interesting what you say about the need not just to look at public spaces in the scale of the neighborhood, but also perhaps the city center. Maybe we can talk a bit about that in a bit. First, I'm wondering, Ilse, because the HERA project, as I understand it, looks at spaces that are designed for encounters, so formal spaces, if you like, and also informal ones. And maybe you can explain us a little bit more about this differentiation, why you're focusing on both. And I'm also very curious to hear what the young newcomers in your research say about the importance of both types of spaces for encounters.
Yeah, so we work a lot with the concept of arrival infrastructure in our project, which takes into account all the parts of the urban fabric with which newcomers interact. And formal spaces are very important because at first people arrive in a lot of formalized spaces. Like everything is so institutionalized for asylum seekers. So you have the police, the reception centers, the language schools. Like there are so many formal spaces where people are at first encountered through. But then next to that, there is a lot of other encounters. And for us, it's really important to look at both spaces because, well, as I said before, we don't take the state as a starting point, so we take the city. So for us, it's equally important to see which spaces people actively go and look for themselves and which encounters they are in need for next to the design governmental spaces where integration is supposed to happen. So I think it's really important to take this relational approach and to look at both spaces. And what we see, I mean, the research is still ongoing, but there are some preliminary findings. And I think in relation to formal spaces, for example, where people learn the language, it's very interesting to see that the informal spaces where people feel relaxed or where they feel more confident, they also often find it easier to speak Dutch, because in these informal spaces, there is also the space, or they feel there is more space to make mistakes. So there is a different environment, a different atmosphere. So it's interesting to see that you have formal spaces where people are learning the language, but then there is other spaces that are equally important to practice and to make contact and to ask the questions that you normally don't ask in these formal spaces that are also designed by policymakers who do not always have the right idea around what really is needed. So I think it's important to look at both spaces at the same time. And another thing that I think, well, we will probably talk about that more, but I think an important aspect of informal spaces is also that people don't feel that they are always identified as a refugee. I mean, that's a really important characteristic. So all of the formal spaces where asylum seekers and refugees go through are spaces that everybody identifies with refugees. And it's important in everyday life to also have spaces where you're not necessarily identified as a refugee.
One thing that's quite unique also is this comparative perspective, right? That you have these different, very different cities. And I'm wondering if this differentiation between formal and informal, if it's the same, if you can say something about this for the different cities, for instance, Leipzig, Brussels, Amsterdam. Do you see a lot of commonalities or also differences in terms of what young refugees see as formal spaces for encounters and the types of spaces that are available to them?
Yeah, so the formal spaces are very closely related to the policies in place. So we see a lot of similarities with Brussels. So the Dutch and the Belgian system are more alike, whereas the British and the German is different. I mean, everything is different and similar, but it's interesting that the national policies are in a way reflected in these spaces. So we in the Netherlands, for example, have a lot of emphasis on civic integration. So there is much more spaces where you're formally thought how to integrate culturally as well. Whereas in...
Can you give an example of civic integration as linked to a type of formal space?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the language class. I mean, they are so dominant. I think in everyday life, there's like language classes take up so much of your time. And the type of conversations that people are having in these language classes are very often about Dutch culture as well. So it's part of the curriculum.
Yeah, it's a mandatory element, right, in the Netherlands, yeah. And were there any really surprising informal spaces for encounters that some of the young newcomers mentioned that really struck you and your fellow researchers?
Yeah, I think the surprising things are also the most ordinary things. So people who really appreciate going to the gym or having a coffee in a Starbucks cafe and really feeling part of the city, I think these more ordinary spaces have so much more meaning than we sometimes think. So what does it mean for a Syrian girl if she can go and have a cappuccino in a Starbucks? She really feels part of the urban landscape in a very different way than when she's sitting in a NGO language cafe setting where everybody kind of identifies her as the refugee. So yeah, it was more the banal or the everyday or the unspectacular spaces. Yeah, where I think it's also easier to blend in. So I think that's the exciting thing about cities. There are so many spaces where you can just blend in and just maybe temporarily be somebody else.
Our research team, of course, the Cities of Refuge team, is based in Middelburg. And I remember a few years back also having conversations with Eritreans in Middelburg about how much they love Rotterdam for that very reason, because they feel indeed that anonymity, being able to blend in, is so much easier in a city like Rotterdam than it is in a city like Middelburg.
So also the diversity is important. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And within the HERA project, how you focus on different types of public spaces, but also the tactics of young refugees and asylum seekers in them and the way they use them. That said, the project, as I understand it, in its design is critical of these very labels, right? Refugee, asylum seekers, and also the debates that surround them. So I would like to ask you if you could say something about how the project in its design is also trying to respond to these contested labels and perhaps also concepts, that's for later, like refugee integration.
Yeah, so representation is a really important topic in our project, and we're interested to research how refugees themselves experience these grand narratives about migration. And we're interested to see how they also position themselves within that discourse. And in the project, we use creative methods, and we collaborate with cultural and art-based initiatives to really explore how refugees also rework public space and how they, you could say how they produce counter-narratives to also challenge these dominant narratives. So we're now preparing a photo voice method workshop in the Molenwijk, an area in Amsterdam North, where we ask refugees from the area to take pictures around the theme of home and belonging and public space. And we're just working together with them to see how they experience public space and how they visualize their experiences. And from interviews and conversations, we already know that they miss many things. Mm. They miss the bus from Syrian cities. Mm. They miss public life in general. And it's interesting because there is a lot of similarities with other residents in the area, because the neighborhood is very boring and very dull. So it's not just refugees who have that experience. I think there's also a lot of commonalities with how other residents or young people appreciate or don't appreciate the public space. So I think that's also for me an exciting part of this research, to focus a bit more on commonalities rather than differences.
Yeah, and it's really interesting what you say, that on the one hand, these impressions enable moments of nostalgia, memories of past places, of past cities. And at the same time, that is also not unique, of course, to young refugees. So we carry with us, of course, these previous attachments and experiences also of perhaps dull and mundane neighborhoods. Yeah. So there's one thing, that's the labels, refugees and asylum seekers. You mentioned that your emphasis on domains of commonality rather than such markers of difference. In the project, what role does the concept like refugee integration play? In previous episodes, we've often touched upon this, refugee integration, both as a notion, but also as a policy objective. And it seems to me that there too, your focus on public space enables you to have a slightly different vantage point.
Yeah, that's true. Our research focuses on newcomers and how they find their way in. And as such, integration is an important concept, especially in the more formal spaces that we are researching. And I don't want to argue that we don't use the concept of integration, because I also think there is, it makes sense in a way to talk about integration. On the other hand, we also look beyond. And we do not only focus on how people find their way in, because that kind of has this idea that you can integrate into something static, something that is already existing. And our main focus is on how people also, with their presence, with their use of public space, change the city. So this more dynamic perspective, where not only refugees change, but everybody and everything is changing. So for me, this concept of integration is limiting in the sense that it has this connotation that there is something that you should adapt to. And I don't think that's, especially in the context of the city, it's so much more exciting to also look at what people bring and what they add and how that creates something new. If you think about the future, like an alternative, or like to bring hope, how can we find a way to live together? For me, integration is not working always the way I would like it to work. So we definitely add something onto it.
It's interesting how you say, you work with it, but you also think about its limitations and beyond them through public space. Can you give an example also of a type of space, public space, maybe in Amsterdam or in another city, where you really clearly see not just, young newcomers fitting in, if you like, but really having an active role in rethinking that public space, maybe even, redeveloping it, if you like?
Yeah, well, this year has been a bit of a strange year, because there's not so much public life in public space. On the other hand, there is actually, if you look at parks, there's a lot of people outside using public space for leisure activities. It's also very interesting to see how the private now moves into the public, because people are so fed up with being inside. So yeah, if you look at urban parks, there is in Amsterdam, in the Oosterpark, there is a group of Eritrean refugees who always play football in one specific corner, and everybody knows they are there at certain times. So they kind of, I don't know if you can use the word claim, but yeah, they are very present, and it's also easy for other people to participate in that activity. People who smoke shisha in parks and attract other young people who are interested in, or play music,
barbecuing.
So I think they don't necessarily change the design, but just by being there and by using the space in a particular way, a new dynamic starts. And I've also heard from young refugees who are new in the city that these kind of spaces are important for them, because they also can easily blend into, when they see somebody speak the language, or they make friends easier because people are present in public space and visible.
Yeah, What I gather, it's not only the different types of public spaces, you mentioned parks, but also the types of interactions within them. So it's not always, we don't always need to be on the lookout for some incredibly innovative art project.
No.
So also the more.
Yeah, again, the everyday. Yeah. And I always find it really interesting to see how, yeah, in the literature and public space, how strangers can become familiar just by sharing the same space or by having the same routine. You start to recognize other people. And from there, like small interactions can start. People start to nod to each other. They say hi. And these really small interactions in public space, they don't necessarily always result in friendships, but they have a meaning. And I remember a Syrian woman, it was in a project that we did together, actually, a Syrian woman saying that, "I don't speak the language, but this Dutch lady nodding at me means so much to me because one day when I'll be able to speak Dutch, I can say something back to her." So in a way, that's also finding your way in through interactions in public space.
Yeah, I remember also from that project, it was a gardens in particular and gardening.
Yes.
And I'm not talking here about flowers, but very much about, edible gardens. And yeah, how interesting it was to see how that also enabled people to really communicate and to become familiar with their environment, but also socially with their neighbors, despite language barriers.
Yes. And again, commonality as well, like within the everyday. Yeah.
Right.
You can find connections even when your language is not, you don't speak the language, you can still find a way to communicate.
Returning to this, the a bit of the elephant in the room, if you like, had the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the pressures on public space. In my intro, I mentioned how I think all of us by now, after a year of witnessing how our daily lives are affected by all sorts of social distancing measures and other measures, are maybe thinking or experiencing public space in different ways. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about how the pandemic and the pressure on public spaces also changed the everyday tactics or practices of the refugee youth and the asylum seekers, perhaps also that are included in your research.
Yeah. So the pandemic has affected everybody tremendously. And here again, I think there is a lot of similarity. So everything around lack of social contact, isolation, suffering from the fact that there is no activities, like also in asylum seeker centers, there are no activities anymore. So people are just in their room doing nothing. More specifically, I've noticed a drop in language skills because people speak less Dutch nowadays, so they don't practice, they don't have the small conversation. And this has a long effect on the long run as well, because not being able to communicate and then you have to just catch up later. The waiting, I think, is really horrible. People in reception centers, but also people waiting for family unification procedures, for example. Everything is being postponed. There are no hearings.
Yeah, returning also to this distinction between formal and informal spaces of for encounter, I'm wondering if you also, and this really very much comes from our Cities of Refuge interest in local authorities, I have to admit, but I'm wondering if you also see instances in which the local state, municipalities are trying to think about the shrinking of public space, whether that's formal spaces for encounters that were available to young refugees or informal ones. And the long-term impacts that it will have on their integration or sense of belonging, if you like.
I'm not sure. Are you asking for specific initiatives that have been taken?
Yeah, for instance, I'm just wondering if I understand very much that you're trying to think also critically beyond the state. But I think for our listeners who are also interested in the interactions, I think it would be interesting to hear if there are also instances in which municipalities are really trying to work with these challenges and, for instance, trying to keep certain spaces, formal spaces of encounters open. If you've encountered any such
Yeah,
instances.
no, there are many examples, I would say. And something that we have come across, especially with young refugees, is the success of co-housing projects. So young refugees who have been living with students or other residents in the city, they've been so positive about the fact that they've been very easily with Dutch people, that they really easier access to information, that they would be taken to parties, that they would meet other people. So I think that's a good example, or best practice, if you like, co-housing initiatives, where in a way encounters are a bit forced, but at the same time, in a housing project where it's also quite normal when you choose for a communal living arrangement that you have interaction with your neighbors. So yeah, I think it especially works well when you, for example, have students living together, where you could just identify as a student rather than a refugee. But also language spaces where more thought is given to what other activities can be organized around language, just given the fact that people spend so much time learning the language, that is a really easy starting point from where you could organize other activities. And yeah, in different cities, there have been great initiatives around that, I would say.
Yeah, very interesting. A slightly different question related to COVID and public space and refugees. I'm wondering, and this comes very much from conversations that I'm having with fellow colleagues and friends who have a background, if you like, as a recently arrived refugee in the city of Utrecht. And I was struck last year that some of them said, well, in a way, we are lockdown experts.
Yes.
So I'm also wondering if this is something that features mm-hmm. in your research, mm-hmm. and if this is perhaps mm-hmm. another domain yeah. of communality. Is this familiar to you, these sort of perspectives?
Yes, very much. And also a lot of the young people we were talking to didn't really understand why people were so stressed about it, because they were coming from a war area. Lockdown was more common sense than it was not.
Yeah,
I remember people also giving advice to volunteers, saying, well, to keep sane, you should have a structure and a rhythm, daily rhythm, eat at the same time, make sure you have social contact. Also with online meetings, you know, with calling friends. I mean, most refugees have been doing online conversation their whole life. So in a way, they're more experts than we. But I do have to say that I was worried sometimes about people with traumatic experiences from war and how lockdown also kind of re-triggers certain war memories. So mentally, maybe you're more prepared, but at the same time, being on your own in isolation also brings back the bad memories. So it also makes it sometimes really more difficult mentally, I would say.
And were there also examples that were given by young newcomers of the sort of places that they missed in particular?
Yeah, I think social encounters. So we did a lot of fieldwork in Boost, which is an NGO in Amsterdam Oost, where a lot of language activities are organized, but you can also have lunch and you can do sports and you can just hang around and meet people. So these are the things that people miss the most. Again, I don't think it's only for refugees. We all miss social interaction the most, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet another question, I guess, is also oftentimes, I remember from previous research that we did as well, that sometimes our interviewees told us stories about walking across cities, small towns, sometimes rural municipalities, walking on the street and being perceived as loiterers, or, you know, lingering in places where they shouldn't be lingering. And it's also crossed my mind in these past few months that nowadays, if you like, all of us are hanging around, and how this idea of hanging around public spaces, whether that's parks or squares, might also be changing mm-hmm. in the long run, and and perhaps also have an impact on the way we think then of young people. We'll have to see.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, well, I'm also really excited to see that there is so much non-commercial use of public space now, which for a public space researcher is really exciting, because we really come from this area of privatization of public space, where you can only be in public space when you buy a drink. So I think that has totally changed as well. So I think that's exciting to see whether young people will still bring their own booze to the park.
Yeah,
after COVID. Yeah.
Time will tell. Mm-hmm. Ilse, as Cities of Refuge research, we're of course very interested also in the relevance of human rights for how city actors welcome but also work together with asylum and seekers and refugees to create those very arrival infrastructures that you mentioned at the beginning. Our focus is often on the actors, state and non-state actors, that use human rights in the city, that invoke and claim human rights, or more generally, a right to the city, if you like. So when it comes to human rights, cities and migration, I see a few interesting common grounds with your research focus and ours. One instance or one example is how young refugees experience public space and navigate challenges that result from their precarious position and spatial marginalization, if you like. They, of course, and their families are often housed in deprived neighborhoods in the cities. In the Netherlands, we see that, as we have seen in our previous research, that they may be housed in small towns, boring ones, if you like, or small rural municipalities as a result of dispersal policies. So asylum seekers and young refugees may face challenges due to these uneven geographies of asylum provision. And these locations are often, of course, generally not of their own choice or that of their own family, which connects to a few human rights questions, most specifically debates on freedom of movement and the right to freely choose one's residence. So one thing that I am curious about, first of all, if these broader questions about particularly the right to residence feature in the stories and the experiences of refugee youth in your current research.
Yes, very much. Yeah. So we have a limitation by focusing on Amsterdam, of course, but by talking to people, we hear a lot of stories about the places that they lived before they arrived in Amsterdam. So many people tell us about how their life was very different when they lived in reception center and then often also in a small town. So in retrospect, we hear about other places as well. And the thing that most young people really appreciate about Amsterdam is the freedom, the anonymity. So this, again, this idea of public space, like you can be whoever you want to be in this bigger city. So it has a lot of positive connotations, but also opportunities in terms of work and education, of course. So this whole policy of dispersal that we're having in the Netherlands, where people do not have any choice in where they are located, I think it is a violation of human rights. So I'm really seeing the, I don't know if they're unintended consequences, but I'm seeing the effects of this dispersal policy, because it can take so long, so much time before people can live where they feel that they have more opportunity.
And in Ilse, these stories of refugee youth and these examples that they give of claiming a space, which could be, you know, very much an everyday act of playing football in a park, but could also maybe touch upon these broader debates like right to residence. Do you ever encounter instances in which your interviewees and other partners talk about this in terms of a language of rights, mm-hmm. like the question whether that's human rights generally, right to the city?
Yeah, some do, but some also really don't. So it's more like our way of framing it, even though I think they claim their right to the city with their activities, but they wouldn't use that language. But we're also working with a group of undocumented refugee youth who are working with an artist on a project where they are going to start a pop-up shop in a shopping street, and they're going to sell some of their art. And these kind of projects, like more art projects, they are very political. And there you see that they really claim the space. They also claim their space in the city center, not in just any neighborhood, but in the city center, because they want to show that they have the right to be there. So some of these projects, you know, when they're political and they talk about urban citizenship, they use that language. But again, I think within the everyday, you can see similar things happening, even when people don't use that framework. I think it's still relevant.
I think this focus on city centers is also fascinating because, again, it's quite a departure from, you know, thinking about refugee integration in terms of settling into your house and your street and your neighborhood. And then just to witness and see how people are really claiming a place and a space in the city and becoming attached to the city as such or the city center is really interesting. Do you have any other examples of this, specifically relating to refugee youth?
Yeah, well, I was also really interested in our interviews that a lot of people, when they first arrived in Amsterdam, they did a lot of tourist activities and they also framed themselves as being a tourist. So they went to the city center, they visited the museum, they took selfies at the really touristic spots. And I think that for me, that was also quite revealing, saying, yeah, of course, why not? You're new to the city, you're exploring, you can be part of the city, you can be a tourist. And I've always been intrigued as well about the difference between a tourist and a migrant. So I think it's interesting when people, you know, themselves also self-identify as a tourist.
Yeah. That's a completely different perspective indeed, I think. And even also returning again to our focus within cities of refuge on local authorities, I wonder, you know, how often these links are made between these different types of migrants, if you like, in the city, whether that's expats, tourists, refugees, and the ways in which they arrive in the city and gradually make it their own. Ilse, one last question. You also mentioned the search for spaces of intimacy, privacy, freedom, hope, and belonging. Could you tell us something more about that? Is that a new focus? Because we've previously talked very much about blending in and anonymity. Can you say finally something about maybe spaces of freedom or how public space is connected to freedom for refugee youth in your research?
Yeah, well, I think that's very much related again to this idea of being able to escape the neighborhood and just seeing the city as a space with unlimited opportunities. So claiming a space, going somewhere where you feel you can be different or you're not watched as well. I mean, some communities are also like really socially controlled. And when you live in a social housing block with many other refugees, because there is often concentration, it might be really liberating to go to another space within the city where you can be somebody else or meet other people. And intimacy, yeah, I also think that it's not necessarily always meeting others. It can also be meeting friends and finding a way where you can meet your friends the way you would want it. So I think that's very important for youth in general as well, to have these spaces.
Absolutely. Ilse, we are approaching the end of today's episode. Is there any question or topic that we missed and that you would still like to briefly share with us?
Oh, wow. No, I think we covered so many interesting things. The conversation also reminded me of this great book called Space Invaders, where also migrants kind of claim the space. And it's so important to also be part of the city center. Yeah, I think it has a really strong symbolic meaning as well. If you think about being pushed away in the ethnic enclave or in the ghetto and then, you know, kind of using the city.
It's a wonderful term. Also coming, we're, you know, returning to the joke about faraway galaxies. And I say that deliberately because I'm aware that for some people, when we talk about space and place, their association is first and foremost galactic.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's been really wonderful to have this conversation.
Ilse, thank you so much for coming on today. And we wish you and your colleagues at the HERA research project also all the best of luck in these times of pandemic with your very interesting research.
Thank you very much.
And to our listeners, until the next time.